running a little late today because we have a full agenda.
And that's part of the magic.
So we're going to go way out of order from the agenda here, and we're going to start with a public hearing and work session on House Bill 4106. I'm going to give us a briefing.
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. 4106 would provide that a city in Clackamas County annex into County Parks and Recreation Services between January 1st, 2005 and December 31st, 2006 by vote of electors is deemed withdrawn from and no longer part of the county service district, which would mean that they would not receive services or have taxes imposed on them. And there are a couple of representatives here to talk about that.
Okay, the saga continues. Representative Meek and Representative Bynum, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Happy to announce the saga ends. Good morning, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Fenley. For the record, my name is Janelle Bynum, and I am the state representative for House District 51. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 4106, which is an essential and critical component of a master settlement agreement between Happy Valley and Clackamas County around the provision of parks and recreation services to their residents. So I'm sure you're aware there's a little bit of history around this, but following the 2019 session and throughout the fall, I worked with Representative Meek and elected officials from Happy Valley and Clackamas County, and I represent both groups of people in my district, and helped them come to an amicable solution that creates some certainty and allows Happy Valley and North Clackamas to provide services to their constituents that they both want and deserve. So we saw success on the House side, and I wanted to just underscore the fact that this bill is a vital component of that overall agreement, meaning we really need this. And it removes Happy Valley and North from the North Clackamas Parks District, North Clackamas Parks and Recreation District. And so without the passage of this bill during the 2020 session, the entire settlement does not go into effect. So that is why I'm urging you to pass the bill so that our community can move forward in a manner that serves and benefits us all, and we can begin to heal. So thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Fenley, members of the committee. My name is Mark Meek, State Representative from House District 40, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 4106, which unanimously passed through the out of the House on Monday. And like Representative Bynum mentioned, this bill will allow Happy Valley to formally withdraw from the North Clackamas Parks and Recreation District. This agreement, though, was the result of months-long work between all involved parties, and I am proud to have had a role in facilitating the settlement process. This agreement, though, will allow both groups to resume working towards creating a thriving parks district that will serve future generations. I'd like to sincerely thank the city and the county leaders who came together as part of this settlement to create a compromise that is both fair and to both the city and protected the integrity of the North Clackamas Parks Recreation District. I would also like to give a sincere thank you for the opportunity to work with Representative Bynum and creating this solution and her leadership with getting this resolved and bringing both parties together and steering us to a process that created a really, I think, a really appropriate opportunity in a settlement. So all parties are proud of this agreement, and it protects both the district's borders and avoids the unpredictability of legal outcomes. And this settlement and this bill, House Bill 4106, will provide both parties the certainty in planning for the future. So thank you, Chairs, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Fenley, and members of the committee. And I hopefully request your support with getting this bill passed. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Riley.
Just a comment. This is exactly the result I was hoping for from last year when we heard it in my committee and encouraged you all to work together for a little while longer, and I think this was a good result, and thank you very much for your good work, both Representative Bynum and Representative Meek. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Okay, we'll take a quick summary from the mayor, Tom Ellis, and Commissioner Ken Humberston. I think this committee is ready to vote this bill out, so if you could be short and concise.
We can do that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Hass. We will be quick.
Okay.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, I'm Ken Humberston, Clackamas County Commissioner, and also a member of the North Clackamas Parks and Recreation District Board. In this dual role, I and my fellow commissioners are charged with considering the needs and protecting the interests of all 122,000 residents of the district. With the assistance of Representatives Bynum and Meek, our jurisdictions have reached a comprehensive agreement that will resolve all legal claims between them, putting an end to multiple lawsuits, appeals, unnecessary legal fees, and years of uncertainty and potential risks. We're pleased by the House's unanimous passage of the bill earlier this week, and we ask for your support here. Lastly, and most importantly, I want to thank Representatives Bynum and Meek for the countless hours they devoted to this effort, and to Mayor Ellis and the Happy Valley City Council for reaching a resolution with the county that will benefit our communities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good afternoon. Good morning, Chair Hass and members of the committee. I'm Tom Ellis, the mayor of Happy Valley. Thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 4106, which comes to you with no opposition after unanimous votes from the House Committee and the House floor. For the past 2 years, Clackamas County, acting as the Board of Directors for the North Clackamas Parks and Rec District and the City of Happy Valley, have been involved in a legal dispute over parks and rec services. We have recently reached a comprehensive agreement that will resolve all legal disputes between us. This agreement will put an end to multiple lawsuits, appeals, unnecessary legal fees, and years of uncertainty and potential risk for both parties. Part of our agreement includes HB 4106. In fact, our entire settlement agreement depends on passage of HB 4106 this session. HB 4106 does one thing. It removes the City of Happy Valley from NCPRD. It is narrowly crafted to apply only to Happy Valley and NCPRD. It does not change the statutory withdrawal process for any other district. No other special district or county service district will be impacted by this legislation. Upon passage of the bill, Happy Valley will become its own parks provider, and NCPRD will move forward with certainty in its boundary and ability to focus on providing services to its constituents. This bill is a shared priority for the city and county, and again, passage this session is essential to put in place our settlement agreement. I would like to publicly thank Representatives Bynum and Meek. They were instrumental in helping us reach an agreement and bringing this legislation forward. I'd also like to thank Chair Bernard, Commissioner Hubbardson, and the rest of the Clackamas County Commissioners for working to find a solution that is beneficial to both parties. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you both, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And I too want to extend my gratitude for everybody who worked behind the scenes to get this to this issue, so that there's agreement ahead of the game before it gets up to the committee. It doesn't always work like that, so. Thank you. Senator Finley.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Chair Hass, I move that House Bill 4106 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Finley moves House Bill 4106 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any objections? Any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 4106 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Taylor will carry this bill. Okay, thank you. All right. We're going to go do these bills. Is this you? These are the companion bills to the Carpentry bill. Okay, I'm going to open up a public hearing and work session on bills, Senate Bill 1504 and 1578. Okay, well, let's do a summary of these bills. I think we have, we know these bills are companion bills to Senate Bill 1530. Is that right, Jamie? And could you give us an overview?
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1504 directs the Department of Environmental Quality to study potential use of government revenue from program placing prices on greenhouse gas emissions and directs an interim report. There's a dash one, which replaces the measure. That dash one defines a carbon dioxide equivalent. It also specifies that the fungible authorizations to emit are not property or subject to Oregon taxation. That was a component that was removed from 1530, and now it's here in this bill and in the dash one. Directs Department of Transportation to study change in fuel classification and requires a study report.
Okay, we have Senator Lee-Byer on his way. In the meantime, Mike.
No, he's sitting here.
Senator Beyer, please come forward.
It wasn't a long way I had to go. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lee Beyer, State Senator from District 6, and here to talk to you about two bills this morning. We'll start out with 1504 with the dash ones. That bill, actually, your staff covered it pretty well. It really does just two things. One is it directs the Department of DEQ and ODOT to do a study on how we tax diesel fuels. We've obviously made a lot of changes over the last couple of years with clean fuels and with weight mile and transportation bill in 2017. So the trucking industry and others suggest that we really need to take a look at that in preparation for the 2021 session. So that's what that one does. The second piece is a clarification that should Senate Bill 1530, the cap and trade bill, pass, it clarifies that allowances that companies get to comply with the law do not constitute property for purposes of taxation, and that's sort of the short form. So that's essentially what it does. Happy to try and answer any questions.
Questions of Senator Beyer? Why separate bills and not together in one? Why two bills instead of one?
The only answer I can give you to that, Senator, is that that's the way Legislative Council wrote it.
Jamie?
So the portion about the property and Oregon taxation was removed from Senate Bill 1530 because of the emergency clause. So they're being addressed as separate bills.
Okay. All right.
Senator Finley. I have a question.
Senator Finley.
Thank you, Chair. Section 3 of 1504 provides tax exempt status for all these. Why is that necessary?
You're going to get me in trouble here, Senator. I don't have the bill in front of me.
And I'm not, that's not my intent, sir. So we can, I
don't have an answer for you. I don't know if Senator Taylor can help. She's been involved in some of these discussions.
You want to go ahead and give the explanation?
Senator Finley, can you ask that question again?
Section 3 of the Senate Bill 1504 says the receipt of funds by state government agency, bottom line is it's not subject to any local tax, fee assessment, or other charges and exempt from taxation under ORS 316, 317, and 318. Why do these need to be tax exempt?
I think that I don't have the bill in front of me, but I'm assuming that relates to the allowances that would be provided.
I think that's correct.
Is that correct?
It does relate to the allowances. Why they need to not be taxable, I can't answer that question up here, but I can look into it for you. Well,
okay.
Thank you, Chair Haas. We can provide more information, more detail, but the intent in the cap and trade is not for that to be considered a source of income. I mean, it's supposed to be tax-free, so we want to clarify that so it's not.
So, and that's fine, and I appreciate that. And a question I asked a few days ago in a hearing on Senate Bill 1530 is we're giving a company $50 million worth of allowances. They're not paying tax on that. They can sell those same allowances and receive remuneration back for those, and they don't pay tax on that. I think that is inappropriate.
So that's just my thoughts. So.
Chair, Senator,
thank you.
I believe if they, the fact that they get the allowances and use them for compliance, that's not a taxable event. I believe if they get the allowances and sell them, that the revenue from the sale probably is a taxable event, but you really want to direct that to the Department of Revenue for clarification. But I believe that's the case.
I didn't have that impression, sir, but thank you. I will.
Thank you, Chair Hass. I think it would be, these are really important questions, and I appreciate you bringing up, Senator Finley, and if, it would be helpful if DOR, working with LRO, and if we could get a solid answer on that, I think it would be very helpful, please. Thank you.
Somebody from DOR here. I don't know if they want to answer your question, but I believe that's the case. Did I misspeak?
Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and Senator Beyer stated that exactly right. The initial award of the allowance or the offset credit, I believe they're called in the other bill, is not a taxable event. It's just given to the entity to comply. At the second level, when they start selling, buying and selling, there is a taxable event. The person that receives the money for the sale of the emissions allowance or whatever it's called, they actually recognize income at that point because they have zero basis in the initial award of the transaction. And the other person who bought it has a business expense for the amount that they paid for the allowance. So Senator Beyer was correct.
Thank you. I just remembered that. It's unusual.
Thank you, Deanna. Thank you, Senator Beyer.
It's fortunate that this law doesn't say that.
All right. Thank you. Mike Liesson and Jenny Dressler, are you, guys want to weigh in here?
Chair Hass, Vice Chair Finley, Michael Eliason with the Oregon Forest and Industries Council, here speaking on behalf, or speaking in support of Senate Bill 1578. Just want to express appreciation to Senator Beyer for reintroducing this year and acknowledging really the intense cost increase, fuels cost increase that folks in the natural resource sector are likely to experience should Senate Bill 1530 pass. So we do appreciate the mechanism. We have some concerns and questions. Well, we have significant concerns, obviously, still about Senate Bill 1530, but the way the fuels piece continues to shift around with every amendment, we still have some questions about how this mechanism and Senate Bill 1578 will mesh should Senate Bill 1530 pass. That said, again, we really appreciate the work and the concept and the acknowledgement of the increase that folks in the rural communities and natural resources are likely to expect from this concept. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hass, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau is the state's largest general agriculture association, representing nearly 6,500 farm and ranch families across Oregon. I'm here today also to express appreciation for Senator Lee Beyer reintroducing what was Senate Bill 1051 from the 2019 session. We asked our members when Senate Bill 1530 was introduced to calculate the cost impact just on the basis of the former Legislative Revenue Office estimate for fuels, and saw price swings for farm families of anywhere between $1,000 and $26,000 in the first couple of years of the program per year in added fuel costs. And we've communicated that with Senator Beyer, or to Senator Beyer, and he thankfully put forward this amendment, or this bill, in an effort to try to alleviate some of that cost burden on our members. So as you guys know, agriculture is trade exposed, and it's one of those, this is one of those very significant concerns for us as part of Senate Bill 1530. Also want to echo some of the questions that we have, given that Senate Bill 1530 hasn't been finalized yet, and the Dash 35 amendment just came out, still trying to figure out how those two are going to interact. And also, when we have members who purchase from the RAC in Portland or Eugene, how those costs are going to trickle down and how this bill will apply to that. But really thankful for this and echo our support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both. We have no others signed up to testify on either of these bills.
Senator Byers.
Senator Byers, you want to come back up?
Once again, Lee Byer, Senate District 6. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I was only focusing on 1504. I thought you were dealing with them separately. So I should comment on 1578 as well, if I may. 1578, as the speaker's just kind of talked about, relates to the cash and cap and trade bill, should it pass. It should look familiar to you because you the legislature passed its predecessor bill, which is really just a mirror of in the last session by overwhelming bipartisan majorities. That bill was signed by the governor but did not go into effect because House Bill 2020 was not signed. Likewise, this one will not go into effect unless Senate Bill 1530 passes as well. They're separate because that's the way they Legislative Council said they had to be separated. And the bill, to be really clear, the bill does really two things. It is attempting to mitigate the cost of the cap and trade program on low-income individuals in affected areas by setting up a tax credit that would compensate them in roughly equal to what they would have paid in additional costs as an effect of that. Second part of it, as the previous speakers talked about, creates a refund program for off-road use by ag and farm vehicles. The monies that would compensate for that come out of the allowances that are sold at auction and are transferred to the Department of Revenue in the case of the credits to cover that cost. So it's not general fund money. It will be the money out of the allowances that pays for that. Likewise, the refunds, which would be operated through the Department of Transportation, come out of that same fund. So just to address those two concerns. Again, I apologize for not covering it.
No, thanks for clarification. We have both bills open. Questions on this bill to Senator Byer?
Thank you.
All right, thank you, sir. I'm gonna close the public hearing and work session on Senate bills 1504 and 1578. We'll let it breathe for a while and move forward and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1560. Jamie will step back here and give us an overview on this, and we have some people signed up to testify in addition to Senator Finley.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1560 is brought to you by Senator Finley, and this deals with the estate tax. In Oregon, we have an estate tax which kicks in at $1 million of estate value. Prior to that, that value is exempt. This bill would propose to adjust that threshold upward, but then at sort of higher levels of estate value, bring the exemption back down towards the current level. And Senator Finley's.
All right, Senator Finley. Senator Finley, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Hass. For the record, my name is Lynn Finley. I'm from Vail, Oregon, and the state senator for District 30, proudly serving Baker, Grant, Harney, Jefferson, Malheur, Wasco, Wheeler, parts of Clackamas, Deschutes, Lake, and Marion counties. Had to write that down because I'd have forgot. Chair Hass, members of the committee, thank you for being here today. I'm here to urge you to support Senate Bill 1560. A little bit of background. For too long, our estate tax law has needed reform. The context of a wider America, 35 states do not have a state tax. 12 states that have a state law concerning taxation of the state
Oregon and Massachusetts are the lowest exemptions in the nation at $1 million. Our neighbors in California, Idaho, and Nevada do not have state tax laws, state taxes. The exemption for these states is $11.58 million, which is the federal limit. It doesn't take much thinking to figure out why people in my district simply move out of state to avoid the lofty taxes we would levy for them to enjoy keeping their hard-earned money while living in a warmer climate. Most recently, the Office of Economic Analysis predicts Oregon is on track to exceed estimated tax, estate tax revenue by $87 million. This biennium. They also stated that the $5+ million estates are on the increase due in part to increases in property values. What I'm proposing is an estate tax reform that will keep Oregon citizens in the state of Oregon. In short, the bill does not abolish the estate tax. It makes it more reasonable. The state exemption would be raised to $2.5 million. The bill then adjusts the exemption based on the estate value. As you have more value, you get less of the exemption, zeroing out the increased exemption by $6.5 million, where the exemption will return into $1 million. This is not an exemption for the rich and famous. This is an exemption for the working families. Oregon's $1 million exemption has been in place too long, and it ignores inflation and the large increases in property values. Interestingly enough, a January 10th, 2020 article in Forbes magazine, we made the list in Forbes magazine, as places that they call "We're Not to Die." Kind of an interesting article. It suggests that if you live in a jurisdiction with low estate tax exemption, you should perhaps move to a no-death tax state. I urge you to support Senate Bill 1560 because it is reasonable reform, one that greatly affects our constituents and keeps Oregonians in the state of Oregon, state of Oregon. So I would be happy to answer questions, but I've asked a CPA from a premier firm in Eastern Oregon to come over and be able to answer those questions much better than I. So.
Sure. Our colleague David Brock-Smith just came in and with anticipation and enthusiasm on his face.
I'm always enthusiastic, Senator, for the most part.
Yep. Oh, you're on.
Oh, thank you. I apologize for my tardiness. David Brock-Smith, State Representative, House District 1, which is Southwest Oregon. Chair Haas, colleagues, I'm here in support of Senate Bill 1560 and my good colleagues that have signed on to the legislation. I'll be brief in that the opportunity for us to increase this for our citizens is extraordinary. Let me tell you why. I believe that we have the opportunity for these individuals that are gonna be receiving this inheritance tax to go ahead and invest it in their own communities and their own children, for example, rather than, I know we have some sort of maybe differences in the ideologies that the individuals of Oregonians can better invest their money versus those that are legislatively invested. And I think that we have an opportunity here for these folks that receive these inheritances that they can turn around and they will probably buy a new car, thus funding the privilege tax that helps enhance the electric vehicle rebate program in the state to transition to a low carbon future, right, Senator? We have an opportunity to then, and they have the opportunity to use these resources to invest in affordable housing across the state as investment properties for long-term rentals. We have an opportunity for them to invest in their own children's college futures, if it's trade school or university sectors. We have an opportunity to allow these individuals to have this increased inheritance, lessening the tax burden on them to invest in Oregon and Oregonians. And so I just would plead to you to come on board with Senate Bill 1560, support your colleague, and it has a sunset, and let's see where it goes.
Questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Thank you for being such a diligent state representative to know what perhaps are some of my priorities here in the Senate. So I appreciate that, Representative Rocksmith. In all seriousness, though, I do think that it's interesting. There's been a lot of, I too have read articles about where our estate tax is, and I am interested in hearing a little bit more about the analysis and making certain, I don't know the details. I mean, we have had some discussions about it in the committee before to see how much of an effect it is, if people truly are leaving the state, and then if that is resulting in us not getting any of that revenue, then that would be something that I'd like to know a little bit more about. I'd like to see the math on that. I'm just wondering if either of you would be supportive of in order for the, if there were to be a change, that in order to, for things to be revenue neutral, that perhaps for some of the higher estates, the higher dollar value estates, that perhaps there could be an increase in that tax rate or something like that. Would either of you be interested in that? At 5 or 10 million estate, you know, the much higher estates.
Chair Senator Taylor, I'm interested in providing some relief for the low and the, you know, the working families, the married couple that spent 35 years working. They both invested in an RIRA and they have a home. I'm interested in protecting those folks. I would be happy to have discussions and look at a deep dive look. I think when my invited testimony CPA comes up, he's going to be able to talk a little bit about the leakage and the impacts, because when you do the impact analysis, fiscal impact analysis, you look at the exact estate tax revenue. He's able to look at some others of if a couple moves away for 20 years, what's that impact? And he's got some. But I would love to have those discussions. I think, you know, this is a good place to start, and we can have some further discussions on a place to go.
Thank you.
Okay, let's bring up some.
I'll let Mr. Lamb come up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Doug Lamb, if you can come up. Appreciate you coming all the way over here. It's a treat for us to hear from people outside of our little circle. So,
Senator Hass and the committee, appreciate your welcoming me here, and thank you, Senator Finley, for the invite. I'm Doug Lamb. I'm a CPA in Ontario, Oregon with the Nichols Accounting Group. We've been in Ontario for 45 years, and we have three offices, one in Ontario, one in Nampa, Idaho, and one in Boise, Idaho. We've got about 50 people, and I happen to be the oldest guy left, so, you know, I don't know what that means, but I get to do some of this stuff instead of every day at the desk. I appreciate your interest in this issue. This is an important issue for our area, especially. You know, I practice in a town of 10,000 people, but if you were to drive the streets of Ontario, you wouldn't think that our business district, you look at it, you go, geeminy, there's only 10,000 people here. We serve about 80 to 100,000 people every day because everybody's rural and they come to Ontario. And so, and this discussion of estate taxes is something that I would say that between myself and different attorneys, you know, Senator Bence's firm and others around, I imagine that we have this discussion about estate tax and solutions for people probably 2 to 3 times a week. And the best solution that we end up offering them in most cases is a simple move of a few miles away. And that's unfortunate. What I'm going to try to show you is that, you know, there's a lot of discussion about revenue neutral, but I think part of the discussion that is being missed is in this calculation, nobody's taking into account the lost income tax from people moving away. And who moves away when they're dealing with an estate tax? It's your people with wealth and higher income. So I'm gonna go to my PowerPoint, and I appreciate you allowing me to use this PowerPoint. It gives me a little bit of factual data to show you. I'm gonna start off with, and I would encourage you, as you have questions, as I'm on each example, just ask them. My intent is to have more of a dialogue than just a speech. And so this is an example. These are all real life examples right out of our practice. I would say in the last 10 years, we've had in excess of 60 couples or singles move out of the state of Oregon from Ontario, Ontario-Nissa area. We're only one firm. We don't represent everybody, and I can tell you that most of the law firms have at least that number as well. So this is an example of a couple that is an Oregon State retired couple. They were both teachers. So thank you, Oregon, for paying their pension, but now they live in Idaho, and Idaho collects that income tax. So they are now, their income tax on their AGI from last year is about $5,700. Their Oregon tax on that same would have been $9,800. So they moved, they are saving $4,100 a year. Nobody will move for $4,100. They just won't, okay? They focus on this down here. Their estate tax on a roughly $3,500,000 estate, when you back out the first million under a trust, you got the rest at death, at the second death, about $150,000 of tax. That gets their attention. I can buy a house or a portion of a house for that, and gone. And so then what you're losing is Oregon's income tax is $9,800. 20 years, these folks are gonna live 20 years. They're all healthy when they leave. That's $197,000, you know, over time lost, plus you lost the estate tax. So my position on this is, you know, the other thing that you don't understand or we aren't talking about is these folks were integral in their community, in their neighborhood. Everybody knew them. They were teachers. And when a bill would come up or a situation for a levy comes up, these folks are not there to vote for that anymore. What does it do to the demographics of our communities? You can just see that it continually declines. So that's my first example, an Oregon State retired couple. Any questions on that?
Senator Riley.
So of that $3.5 million estate, how much of that leaves the state?
All of it.
How can that be when much of it is in land?
Not much of it is in
land. They've moved. They don't own anything left in
Somebody
Oregon.
Somebody does.
Not these folks.
No, but somebody owns that land. Okay. So that $3.5 million did not leave the state. It's still here, just somebody else owns it.
The only thing that they had in this case that was real estate would be their home in Oregon. The rest of it is investments.
All those
follow your, you know, all of your personal property follows your state of residency, correct? You know, if you own Boeing and you live in Oregon, you don't pay an estate tax to Washington because you own Boeing.
That's right.
And it's, same thing with, you know, most of your investments.
Great. That answers my question. Okay. Thank you.
But to your point, their home is still there. Somebody else owns that home. Mm-hmm. Would those people be in excess of whatever the threshold is? Who knows?
Who knows?
Right. Thank you. Any other questions on that one? This next one. Oops, I need to go back one, please. I must have jumped.
Oh.
I wanted to go to the retired single person. There we go. One more forward, please. Thank you. Okay, this is a widow. They moved several years ago. Husband and wife moved. He's since passed away in Idaho. Her AGI is pretty healthy. They had been good business owners. Her Idaho income tax, $10,000. Oregon, $14,000. Again, she wouldn't have moved for that amount. Her estate, roughly $6 million. So in the current law, her $542,000 is her estate tax. Under the proposed tax of 1560, it'd be $506,000. So it's a little smaller. So that goes to, as you go higher, this threshold, this additional exemption does drop. And so in this case, at $6 million, she only gets about $300,000 of additional exemption. And so the income tax in her case lost over 10 years is roughly $280,000. And that, in her case, that does not equal what the estate tax would have been. But it's gone anyway because she left, because she focused on the estate tax. So another example of someone that's left the area, very influential in her neighborhood, in her community, now gone. Any questions on her? What I'm trying to point out is the impact is far beyond the revenue. Final one, and this is where I would suggest that, you know, 1560 is a good start, but I'm not sure it should stop and then come back down, because this example, and in this kind of example, maybe we would never have kept them in Oregon anyway. They're AGI, young, these folks are in their early 50s, both professionals. They made the move probably 15 years ago. This was what their income tax would have been last year, $90,000 in Oregon, $65,000 in Idaho. So for $27,000 a year, yeah, they might have moved just on that, okay? But that wasn't their motivator. The estate tax for them, their Oregon tax lost over the 20 years, $1.8 million. You're gonna lose a lot more than 20 because they left early and they're young. On their $15 million rough estate, it's the same number both ways, but your loss on income tax far exceeds what the estate tax would have been. So, and again, what happens to your community in your own neighborhood if your teachers have now left because they had a nice retirement from the state of Oregon, your older retired business owners have now left, your professionals have now left, what's left in your cities, in your communities, in your neighborhoods, especially when something comes up that needs a levy vote and you're trying to, you know, promote something for your schools or for your community college. And so what we see is just this erosion of our demographics in our community, and the whole fabric of the community changes. Just come to Ontario and look at what it was 15 years ago, which you can't see now, but I can tell you about, compared to now. It's significantly different. And it's not just Ontario. Yes, sir.
Doug, I noticed that you're putting up the other taxes here, the Idaho income tax. You're not putting up the Idaho sales tax. They're a sales tax state.
Sure. But most of those people are coming to Idaho, to Oregon, to buy their stuff. That's the reality of living on the border.
Okay.
But you're right. That sales tax could come into play. And what's interesting is in sales tax, even if they don't come into Oregon to buy their groceries, what are they really getting out of sales tax on? Groceries. There's not much else. They're coming over. You know, they might be buying some supplies. But all their vehicles are going to get taxed. Anything that has to get registered is going to get taxed. You don't pay sales tax on purchases of real estate. You don't pay sales tax on purchases of investments. Mm-hmm. You know, so there is a factor there. I just don't know how to math it. And the reality is most of those folks are shopping in Ontario. So Ontario does have a nice shopping district because of its proximity to Idaho. Other questions?
Senator Cano.
Thank you. First of all, I want to thank you for suggesting that someone who's in their early 50s is young.
It's all relative, isn't it, Senator?
You probably mentioned this earlier. Idaho's estate tax is?
Zero.
Nevada's estate tax?
Zero.
Washington?
Washington has a $2 million exemption.
And what about California? Okay, thank you.
Yeah. One additional thing I should have brought out. I mean, we've got Idaho's income tax, as you can see, is less. The estate tax at the federal level is, roughly $11 million per person now. Due to sunset, come back to roughly $5.5 million. Bottom line is, these estate taxes, we could argue all day long on, all the issues of estate tax or anything else. I'm just trying to point out that, number one, I'm not sure it's a total loss when you move this up because you're losing so much now on everybody on the borders that have left. And number two, the impact it's having on our demographics. You can't put a number to that, right? It's just something that's not possibly done.
Well, it's not just the borders.
Sure, it's not.
And if you spend 180 plus days in another state, you can still enjoy whatever you want to enjoy in Oregon during the seasons that you enjoy in Oregon. So that's still there. But I think your point is well taken, that the investment in community shifts. If somebody moves to Boise, they lose contact with Ontario or Bend or Portland or whoever.
Sure.
And they start their charitable giving shifts. And so I think it's way more of a loss than simply the loss of income tax or estate tax. I think the loss is really immeasurable in our communities when we see high net wealth people moving. And this has been happening for decades. It's just now that there are few states that have the estate tax like Oregon has, it has given people many more options of where they can go as they get older. And I can tell you that I've been contacted, I think, twice already this session by people who have just been blunt, let's fix this issue or we're leaving. And so I know there are many, many more out there, but that's just two in, you know, just a few weeks.
I can tell you that I have numerous people that have already told me this year, this is the year they're moving. Yeah. And I would be surprised if members of this committee have not been told by their financial advisors they should consider leaving. I mean, it goes against your grain. I understand that. And I have, you know, Senator Bentz, a lot of other people in Ontario that are, they're homers, okay? These folks that have left, they're Oregon, University of Oregon graduates. They bleed green, but they've left. And I get that hurt of wanting to move because I grew up in Idaho. I decided not to move across the border when I moved, and so I live on the Idaho side, have for all my life. And I know how hard it would be for me to pull up roots and move into Oregon. So my friends that are living on the Oregon side that are moving into Idaho, it's got to be heart-wrenching to do that. And the loss they have in the connections in their communities are significant. Now, some of them, if they only move 3 miles away, they're still involved to some degree. They might still go to the same church, but a lot of them don't. But I'd be surprised if you folks haven't been approached by this as well, because it's just a dollars and cents issue.
I'm sorry, Senator Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So one of the things I've noticed, from California has zero estate tax, is that true? And but our cities in Oregon keep growing from people coming from California. And I'm not quite sure why that is. We seem to really grow in our cities here, except on the border with Idaho. The borders with California, we have all the California people on this side.
Yeah.
The borders with Idaho, I understand that. That's true. We have people even from this area moving to Idaho. They're mostly Republican, by the way. But but it's true. But we have a lot of folks from California, and we're not losing population in Oregon. We never have. We're a big influx state, and I don't quite understand why, if every place else in the country is better than we are at tax, why are they coming here?
I would suggest that most people don't think about some of those things before they leave. People that are wanting to get out of California have a whole list of reasons they're trying to leave. Yep, and some of those other taxes that they deal with in California are even more difficult than having no estate tax or picking up an estate tax here. I can just comment relative to my own experience, which is a border experience.
Right.
And you guys have been, you know, you've heard quite extensively from us over the last couple, 3 years regarding border-related things with Senator Bentz's efforts and Senator Finley's efforts. So thank you for your support of what you've given us. We've needed it. Mm-hmm. So in summary, I think, you know, we need to try to find a way to stop the loss of income tax, because there is a loss. And you're losing that future estate tax as people leave. Had those people not left, some of them wouldn't have had any estate tax, but they would. Some of them would have had, and stop the erosion of our fabric of our communities. That's really my point, is the fabric of our communities is the thing that becomes the most dangerous in what and not just saddening, but also dangerous when you see what's happening. So thank you for listening. I really appreciate it. Thank you for your questions.
Mr. Lamb, we appreciate you coming over here and
my pleasure.
Sharing your perspective. Any other questions, Mr. Lamb? All right. Thank you, sir. We do have a list of what I would consider to say affectionately familiar faces on this issue. So given the fact that we still have to do another bill after this, I'd like to just, without setting up a big timer, try to persuade you to keep your testimony under 2 minutes. So we'll just kind of go back and forth here in no particular order and start off with Lori Wimmer.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer, representing 45,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, here today with respectful disagreement to the approach for dealing with the problem that has been identified and therefore in opposition to Senate Bill 1560. We think that there might be a better way to approach the problem solved, maybe pegged to a housing value escalator at the low end and raise the rate over $6 million, as Senator Taylor mentioned, to keep it revenue neutral. But with the sidewalks of our cities filled with tents, with the nation's highest rate of unhoused youth, with half our school children living in poverty, with 400,000 Oregonians unable to access health care, with college student debt soaring, with insufficient services for our mentally ill, and with foster care systems struggling to meet demand, it's really hard to understand why now would be considered a good time to raise the amount of transferable wealth for our most affluent. There's already plenty of estate planning tools that exist to lessen the estate liability heirs would otherwise have without increasing the threshold. Already this session, advocates have come forward to ask for resources for many worthy programs, either never before funded or funded inadequately. The answer to most such requests has been no. We're told that prudent fiscal management requires that we spend less, save more, and prepare for the next inevitable rainy day. If that argument is true on the budget side, why wouldn't it be equally true on the revenue side? In effect, revenue reductions are just like budget expenditures, particularly if the goal is fiscal restraint. In past sessions, Oregon's legislators have worked on this tax to assure that estates related to farming, forestry, and natural resources are generously protected. The work to improve this tax has already been completed from our perspective. We believe that income inequality undergirds many of Oregon's most pressing problems. Please do not make them worse by giving yet another tax break to the affluent while limiting services to the poor. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Any questions? Thank you. Kevin Mannix.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Kevin Mannix, one of the usual suspects. On behalf of Common Sense for Oregon, I'm a Salem attorney. That's my usual job, but I do parachute in on some issues, especially the estate tax. Last session, you had four bills in front of this committee, different bills, adjusting, trying to change the estate tax, one eliminating the estate tax. I testified on those. I heard the four senators who sponsored them. This is a novel approach. This is a shift. It says, let's do some adjusting here, but let's help the folks at the lower end of the scale, convince them to be willing to stay in Oregon. You heard the moving issue, but also be willing to be paying those Oregon taxpayer tax dollars. When you become a non-resident, you don't pay taxes in Oregon except for Oregon income. And we do lose this. There was a national study, and because that came up this morning during testimony, I had not looked it up, but I remember reading a national study that said that Oregon is one of four states which actually loses revenue because of the current estate tax structure. And that's because of the loss of income tax revenue from certain persons who leave, as opposed to the amount of estate tax we collect. And perhaps legislative revenue may take a look at that article, but there is that argument. In terms of why we do this, Oregon is one of only 12 states left that have an estate tax. In 2002, all 50 states had estate taxes. So, you know, we're in a competitive environment. Since then, 38 states have eliminated their estate tax or let them go away. And yes, California, Nevada, Idaho do not have estate taxes. Washington does have an estate tax, but their exemption is $2.2 million. Now, to talk about Senator Taylor's point, their top rate is 20%, so they have a higher top rate. But for the lower income folks, and yes, I will say that, lower income, people who worked all their lives and put together an estate, we're making a difference with this bill. So, a novel approach that would help lower level estates, and at some point in the future, or perhaps even in amending this bill, one might add to the top tax rate to make up for the revenue loss within the estate tax. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Kevin? Thank you, sir. Could I go to John Calhoun?
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley,
My name is John Calhoun. I'm representing Tax Fairness Oregon, referencing the testimony that Jody has submitted. A reminder on our inheritance taxes, the exemption is $1 million per person, $2 million per couple. It's not just $1 million. And for farms, it's $7.5 million and $15 million. This bill will reduce our revenue. We can't take care of foster kids who are transitioning out of foster care today because we don't have the revenue going forward. Yet we're talking today about giving money to millionaires who and their children who didn't earn it. The comparison is just out of whack. There is no offsets here. I appreciate Senator Taylor's comment of maybe there could be some offsets to keep it revenue neutral. We don't have a mass exodus. Ontario may be different. I respect that. But as a state, we shouldn't drive our tax policy by one city or one locale. Our revenue from inheritance taxes continues to grow, meaning that most people are not leaving the state. Most people who move do not move for taxes. There are always some exceptions, but most people move for son, children, or health. And there are lots of people who are very wealthy who do not want to leave Oregon simply because of this tax. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Thank you. Chris Vogel. Did you want to come up with your partner, Josie, or do you guys teaming up?
Good morning, Senator Haas and members of the committee. I'm Chris Vogel, representing the League of Women Voters, and I'm here to share with you testimony from Josie Cohen, who's just been submitted in writing. The League of Women Voters believes that any tax policy should be evaluated with regard to its effect on the entire tax structure, and that it should be based on an ability to pay. Based on that position, we would oppose this bill. About 96% of all Oregon estates in 2017 were worth less than $1 million and paid no estate tax, but the estates that did qualify, 1,791, brought in $192 million of revenue in 2017. And in 2020, LRO Basic Facts indicates that $204 million of revenue was generated from the few estates that paid the tax. The League feels that the current system already provides good options for reducing estate taxes. They're badly needed for many basic services, and we would encourage you to oppose this bill.
Anthony Smith.
Chair Haas.
Are you for this or against?
Did I not mark the box?
No.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee, for the record, Anthony Smith, Oregon State Director for NFIB, representing thousands of small businesses across the state, many being the smallest of small business. I'd like to thank Senator Finley for bringing this forward, introducing Senate Bill 1560. Also like to express my thanks to the chair for scheduling today's hearing on this important issue. In a recent survey of our members in Oregon, an overwhelming 88% of respondents supported the complete elimination of Oregon's estate tax. This bill takes a different approach, but it's a step in the right direction and hopefully the beginning of a thoughtful dialogue on the subject of estate taxes that we think is long overdue. I won't rehash, I'll give you the quicker version of my testimony today, and I won't go into all the details that have already been covered by the other panelists, but I did want to mention that the estate tax imposes a disincentive for small and family-owned businesses to grow the net worth of their businesses over time, especially for businesses that are preparing to pass the family business on to the next generation. The threat of this tax actually forces small business owners to pay for expensive estate planning if they want to keep their business in the family, and much of the cost of having an estate tax on the books actually occurs before the tax is levied itself. Nationally, just over a third of NFIB members incurred tax planning expenses in the 5 years leading up to the passage of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which doubled the federal exemption threshold. That figure has most likely dropped nationwide because of the increase, especially for small businesses in states without an estate tax or an inheritance tax, but probably not for NFIB members in Oregon, where we have the lowest exemption threshold in the country at $1 million, which we heard about. We're tied with Massachusetts. At its worst, the estate tax can tax a family right out of business, and while the owner of the estate is responsible for the tax, their heirs are often responsible for the actual payment of the tax upon the death of the owner. For estates comprised mainly of illiquid assets like land or a building, coming up with the cash to pay the tax can be a major challenge. And just want to make one more point, Mr. Chair. You may have read articles or heard anecdotes about the accidental millionaire, and we heard a little bit about that yesterday from The Economist when they were talking about the rise of property values and how there's a lot of middle-class families who have worked all their lives, some of them business owners as well, who have accumulated assets and have no idea that they need to prepare for this. And because of the value of those assets that have increased in those years leading up to retirement and then when they pass, they're really leaving their families in a tough spot. So we would love to see a meaningful conversation about this. And if for some reason this doesn't move forward, we would love to work with you guys, and we would really like to focus on that dynamic modeling that that the presenter earlier was talking about. We would really like to see that, to see if this could be actually, you know, reform could actually be a good thing for the state. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you, Anthony. No questions. Thank you. Okay, that's the end of our witness list. So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1516. I would like to say this, that it's been my longstanding policy as the chair of this committee that whenever committee members have a bill that they introduce and gets referred to this committee, we hold a hearing on it. It's just been my policy, and I think that's been good for the committee, and it's been good for the public. It's been good discussion. And with respect to the policy on this bill, Senator Findley, I think, has come up with a creative way to look at those people who are just bumping up against the estate tax. In my district, million-dollar houses are not rare at all. And I think you're onto an approach, and if we can get there some way that is a revenue-neutral solution to help the families that Mr. Lamb was talking about, some of the families in Senator Taylor's district, my district, I think we can get there. So I appreciate this discussion from everyone. And with that, we'll move on to the next bill. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 1531, our favorite bill of the session, Interstate Broadcasters. Kyle, you're going to discuss the new amendment?
Which one do you want me to hit on?
Okay. What were you going to do?
I can talk about what's in here, what we added.
Nobody.
I provide just what we have in here.
Well, I'm sorry, I went to 1531.
Oh, yeah. This is the element. Did you want to do the broadcast?
Yeah, let's, the time we have, let's go to broadcasters. I'm going to close that work session. I think we won't have time for 1531. I'm sorry. I don't see the Interstate Broadcasters on here, so we're going to. I'm going to open up a work session on 1529. It was right in front of my nose. And we will revisit a technical bill tomorrow. Sorry, old age. So we have a new amendment. Do you want to discuss, or how would you like to start?
I can just provide an update of where we are.
Yeah, just a refresher. We had the ones and twos and threes on this bill, and Chris and others have been working behind the scenes with what I hope is a compromise of sorts. And so these will be the fours. Are they up on OLIS now?
They are not. We, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've made some progress. We've shared it with the stakeholders, and there are still issues to be worked out.
Okay. You can give us an overview of the concept?
Sure.
Okay.
The concept, though, is, so part of the debate here is to stick with a policy where interstate broadcasters are singled out as a type of taxpayer. And then if a company is an interstate broadcaster, then their income is apportioned either this audience method or the commercial domicile method. The introduced version of the bill moves away from that and puts companies into market-based sourcing, similar to how the state moved in 2017 for the base corporate income tax for service and intangible companies. This potential compromise or other avenue here sticks with largely the market-based sourcing, but does single out and tries to tighten up some of the requirements around the audience apportionment and get away from using population and try to encourage and set up a structure where there will be more audience-based method for certain streams of revenue, basically advertising and potential licensing, where audience information is available from third-party vendors. And potentially in cases where that information is not available, then one option might be to use commercial domicile in those instances. And so the way that we're thinking about this right now is kind of a compromise in between the two approaches.
Okay, so I don't want to say the word revert, but we'll use essentially go back to the corporate income tax, which means audience, except for, what was the phrase you used? Where audience couldn't be determined.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, so the streams of revenue, one of the themes or the approaches with market-based sourcing is rather than looking at a company and say, okay, this company is this type, so we're going to tax it this way. It's you look at the revenue stream, and in this day and age where we have conglomerates of companies that do multiple things, it's focusing on that revenue stream. And so the idea of focusing on broadcasting revenue, it would be apportioned this way. And we're still talking with stakeholders of each side right now to figure out that path forward and what might work. But that would be potentially limited use of commercial domicile. And one of the things that we encountered, Kate and I, when we were working on the report through the summer and the fall, were potential conflicts of when the audience could be used or not be used. There are certain cases where taxpayers seem to propose an audience method and DOR felt they were unable to accept that approach. And I mean, this gets really into the weeds of those examples, but trying to iron out some language that doesn't restrict a DOR from accepting certain audience calculations proposed by the taxpayer. And that's kind of the approach that we're on right now. And we've started with the amendment, but it's not quite ready because there's still disagreements on each side.
Okay, kind of high-level discussion, but I appreciate the movement here that kind of combines both worlds and compromise that... That's good. And when will the amendment be finished to the point where we can make it public?
There's a meeting in a few minutes now. With any luck, we can hopefully get that ironed out. So we are moving as quickly as we can.
Okay.
Thank you. I think that's a great stroke.
Yeah. Great work, Chris. And to the stakeholders who are involved, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1529, and we are out of time. I'm sorry for those of you who have been hanging around on the technical fix bill, but we'll get to it tomorrow.
We need to carry it over to tomorrow.
Yeah, so I will carry over 1531 tomorrow and carry over 1529 tomorrow. And we have what else on that docket tomorrow?
Work sessions for
the work sessions for the two carbon bills. So, thank
just
you.
Just a point of order. I'm not sure. I don't know what the. I'm sorry, Senator Hess.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you. I just wanted to. The two bills relating to carbon. Do we need to state on the record that those are carried over? Does we not need to do that?
Are they scheduled?
They are already scheduled.
Okay. I'm sorry. Just clarifying. Thank you.
So.
That's why I'm not going home tonight.
good home tomorrow.
And so we'll be back tomorrow at the regular time of 8:30. We are adjourned.